Hello, welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader in Flagstaff, Deborah McFadder, with excerpts from Yes Media, a nonprofit, independent publisher of solutions journalism. Through rigorous reporting, Yes Media inspires people to build a more just, sustainable, and compassionate world. We begin today with an article called Voices Beyond Votes. It's written by Laura M. Quintero and Camille Padilla Dalmo, and it was first published September 4th, 2024. Usually I describe to you how these articles start with a drawing or a photograph, but this one is just plain gray, dark at the bottom and going into a lighter gray at the top. Alicia Nipote still remembers the call she received 16 years ago that sparked a movement in Rio Piedras. That day, her church's reverend told her that the municipality of San Juan, Puerto Rico's capital city, was expropriating the property where they congregated. "We were shocked," she says. Nipote could not believe the municipality was threatening to strip the church of the building it had existed in for 50 years. The church sat on Arzuaga Street, one of the main streets in Rio Piedras, teeming with small, locally owned businesses. Nipote and the Reverend immediately set a meeting with CAUCE, the office that serves as a liaison between the University of Puerto Rico, the community, and the government. During that meeting, they learned that San Juan's then-mayor, Jorge Santini, had announced a development, Rio 2012, that included the demolition of more than 100 buildings in Rio Piedras. He wanted to rebuild Rio Piedras by destroying Rio Piedras, recalls José Luis González, a resident of García Ubarri, one of 8 communities that surround the historic center. That summer, 180 people gathered at the First Baptist Church of Rio Piedras to form the community board of the Rio Piedras urban area, with representatives from the 8 communities surrounding Rio Piedras. Attendees signed a community manifesto that established an alternative plan to Rio 2012, one that would secure affordable housing. After 5 years of organizing, the Rio Piedras community successfully blocked Santini's plan from being implemented. The community board at the time did a lot of advocacy, says Monica Ponce Caballero, director of CAUCE. With proposals and data, we paralyzed the project. That has been our most significant achievement. After that victory, the community succeeded in amending the Rio Piedras Rehabilitation Act to include a land trust that ensures affordable housing and helps avoid gentrification. The community board's involvement in policymaking, campaigning on social issues, organizing neighborly meetings, and debating ideas is an example of how people civically engage beyond Election Day. Above all, it's an instance of a community working toward issues that matter to them in a context where there is no real democracy. Disenchanted but not disempowered. Puerto Rico is not a democracy because it is a colony. And in a colony, by definition, the people do not give themselves their own laws, says Joel Colon Rios, professor of law at the University of Essex in the United Kingdom. However, this does not mean that democratic spaces cannot exist in Puerto Rico. A true government by the people should not only be about participating in discussions, but about making binding decisions about the rules and policies that apply to the community, he adds. For that to happen, it usually requires a change in the legal system. Although Puerto Rico has a governor and a legislature elected by its residents, the U.S. government does not recognize the Puerto Rican people's sovereignty, and therefore the island's government cannot engage in foreign affairs and is restricted from importing goods through non-U.S. ships. Congress can decide when to exclude Puerto Rican residents from the labor rights or social benefits available to other U.S. citizens. The archipelago chooses a resident commissioner in Washington, D.C., who is a delegate of Congress, but has no vote. And now there is a color photograph that shows as if the camera was right down on street level. The street is all torn up with big potholes, and there's rain that's collected in these spaces in the road. Someone is walking on a sidewalk, and behind the person walking on the sidewalk is a tall, maybe 8 foot tall metal fence with spiky tops to it. And beyond that, we can see through to a building that has a painting on the side of it of a man with a gray beard and red, white, and blue stripes in the background behind him. The sky is overcast. In Puerto Rico, local elections have become irrelevant for many people, particularly since 2016, when the U.S. imposed a fiscal control board that orders budget cuts and uses its veto-like powers to ban legislative measures. Austerity measures within the municipal and central government, along with bureaucracy, complicate even small requests from the community, such as repairing sidewalks. The construction for a sidewalk in Rio Piedras took more than a year, and they did a bad job, says Rahisa De Luca Morales, a representative of the Blonde residents in the community board of the Rio Piedras urban area. In a way, the community organization enables it to be done and to be demanded, but delaying the process and doing it badly discourages people. As a result, many communities in Puerto Rico don't get the support or resources they need, and they have become disenchanted. Because of the situation in the country, people are very tired, says Jackie Garcia Flores, current president of the Rio Piedras Community Board. When you invite people to get involved, they ask themselves, what for? Political apathy is an increasingly global phenomenon, particularly when it comes to voting. In the 2020 U.S. presidential election, 34% of the voting eligible population decided not to participate, according to the University of Florida Election Lab. The 2020 election held the highest turnout in more than a century, but voting turnout has not surpassed 80% since 1888 and 70% since 1900. The voter turnout rate has been lowest among people between ages 19 and 29 and non-white populations over the past 38 years. And since this data only refers to eligible voters, it excludes a large portion of the population. An estimated 30 million people are prohibited from voting because they have a felony, are a non-citizen, or live in a U.S. territory. But voting is far from the only way to participate in a democracy, and for those who choose not to vote or who are denied the right, communities are coming up with creative ways to have their voices heard. Now another color photograph with a great long-range perspective. On either side of the photograph are buildings that look like they're about two or three stories tall. On one side of the street, they're pale pink and white, with black wrought iron balconies on the second and third floor. On the left side of the picture, the building is light blue and white, and the same thing with the wrought iron balconies. Some of them have the Puerto Rican flag flying from the balcony. And then as we look way, way down the street to the point of almost the vanishing point of this picture, we see a large white building that might be a government building. Across the street is another large flag from Puerto Rico stretched so it gives shade. An undemocratic system. The U.S. is typically described as a representative democracy because people elect representatives who make the laws. Colon Rios says electing officials is just the first part. For a system to be described as a representative democracy, it is not enough to have an elected legislature, but rather an elected legislature that adopts laws consistent with the preferences and interests of the people, he says, and that should include all voters in the U.S. and its territories. The problem in the U.S. and other purportedly democratic countries is the clear disconnect between people's desires and the laws that are passed. Multiple polls show there is general support in the U.S. for increasing the corporate tax to fund essential services, lowering prescription drug prices, and making health care more affordable. Meanwhile, young voters' top priorities are legislating gun control increasing access to reproductive health care, and reducing the causes of climate change. Yet legislation relating to these efforts regularly stalls in Congress. This disconnect is partly because many legislators come from economic and social classes whose interests they defend, Colon Rios explains. According to Open Secrets, a nonpartisan nonprofit tracking money in U.S. politics, more than half of U.S. Congress people in 2018 were millionaires. That's a huge contrast to the 7% of people in the U.S. who have assets higher than $1 million. Furthermore, while white males represent 30% of the population, they represent 62% of office holders, according to a 2021 analysis by the Reflective Democracy Campaign. The result is that the laws they adopt often protect the interests of certain groups over the interests of the majority, Colon Rios explains. In fact, the money spent on corporate lobbying has doubled in the past two decades, according to the People's Action Institute. An increasing number of organizations are working to change that. The Reflective Democracy Campaign proposes shifting power from donors, politicians, and influencers who control endorsements and funding to grassroots leaders. The campaign gives grants to grassroots organizing groups like Michigan United, Take Action Minnesota, and the Texas Organizing Project to train their members to advocate for their communities in a variety of roles as activists, organizers, campaign managers, and elected or appointed officials. This model was also adopted by the People's Action Institute, which focuses on building power for poor and working people through training, endorsing, and campaigning. The Institute works as a coalition of 42 state and local grassroots organizations that developed a people's platform and endorses candidates who pledge to implement it. They say that in 2022, their members knocked on millions of doors, made millions of phone calls, sent a million texts to support endorsed candidates, and helped elect 9 candidates to federal office and 75 to state legislatures. You are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. Some organizations, including the Asian American Women's Political Initiative and Advanced Native Political Leadership, are focused on increasing diversity and the representation of historically marginalized communities, while others promote methods to make government more responsive to the community, like participatory budgeting. For example, the Participatory Budgeting Project facilitated a process with Bushwick Schools in Brooklyn, New York. Their task was to collectively determine how best to spend $250,000 from the office of the Brooklyn Borough President for a school safety program. Students, family members, and staff brainstormed, created proposals, and finally voted on a plan to renovate gender-neutral bathrooms and expand a restorative justice program. Now another color photograph. This is taken, I imagine, in Puerto Rico, because at the very center of the photograph is someone holding a bright yellow poster that says Puerto Rico Salida de Rosella, Wanda Vasquez Nova. Around the person holding this poster, we have a crowd of people, and they're waving many different Puerto Rican flags. Most of them have on summer-like clothes, baseball caps. There are mostly men in this picture. Behind them, we see a street going away from them, and the buildings, again, are that pale pink on one side and white on the other. Voter apathy is not political apathy. Displeased with their political representation and government bureaucracy, some groups prefer to create non-governmental institutions where they have a say, such as the case of the agroecological farmers, who in 2010 organized the Institute for Agroecology in Puerto Rico, which was formalized as a nonprofit in 2018 after Hurricanes Irma and Maria. When Hurricane Maria landed, things were excessively precarious, says Carlos Figueroa Robles, operation manager at the Institute. In the aftermath, Puerto Rico was receiving donations from both individuals and foundations, but in order to receive those funds, projects needed to be incorporated as nonprofits and have permits, such as 501c3 status. Figueroa Robles says the institute had to become a legal entity that could facilitate the process of accessing these funds. For the state, agroecological farmers aren't farmers, he says. Many agroecological farmers do not meet the Department of Agriculture's requirements to be certified as a bona fide farmer because they do not make enough income, have enough land, or cannot provide proof of ownership. On the U.S. Department of Agricultural side, much of the paperwork requires technical knowledge and English proficiency. These barriers limit access to benefits and funds. These obstacles result in poverty for these families, adds Figueroa Robles, who is pursuing a doctorate in social work at the University of Puerto Rico. The Institute for Agroecology is run by an advisory board, most of them member farmers. Twice a year, they meet to tell the nonprofit's working group what their priorities should be to better serve their members' needs. In 2022, the Institute for Agroecology joined forces with other organizations to create the FIONA Fund, which offers 5 months of supplementary income to 50 agroecological operations. The goal is to accompany all these initiatives in order to reduce the administrative burden imposed on them, and thus be able to generate well-being and validate their practices through research and participatory assistance efforts, says Figueroa Robles. The rising cost of rent is another challenge for farmers in Puerto Rico. In the past 40 years, Puerto Rico has lost more than 511,000 acres of agricultural lands, according to the Federal Agricultural Census. This is largely due to the speculative real estate market and overdevelopment. We are being displaced, says Figueroa Robles. Instead of containing power and centralizing it, we need to democratize it so that the people who are custodians and work the land can make decisions and have democratic governance mechanisms to implement it. Melmory Aguilar Rios, a third-generation farmer from Mayagüez, a town in western Puerto Rico, turns the produce she harvests into juices and food that she then sells from her food truck, Ecando Reyes. For the past 5 years, she's been restoring the soil of a farm she holds under usufruct, but now the owner wants her out. Since she's a founding member of the Community Land Trust, the Institute for Agroecology, launched in 2023, she now has the opportunity to work on land she co-owns with other members of the collective. Thanks to the trust, I can feel more secure about having a space where we can go to farm and they won't take it away from you, she says. Colon Rios says democratizing society requires us to work collectively from the bottom up, but he emphasizes that the making of binding decisions depends on the political system recognizing the validity of these spaces, that is, recognizing the decisional power of these spaces. For this recognition to happen, Colon Rios says the groups struggling for a change need to build a wide political force, either by forming a social movement or a political party. He pointed to Chile's uprising for constitutional changes as one example, and the ousting of Governor Rosello in Puerto Rico as another. To achieve systemic change, it is necessary to identify demands common to all groups struggling for change, adds Colon Rios. Now a color photograph that's taken in front of the United States Capitol. It has six individuals in the photograph, four men in suits and two women, one in a pale blue pantsuit and another one in a sort of a gray jacket. They are standing at a lectern that says Puerto Rico Status Act, and behind them we can see the dome of the Capitol. Reader's note, this article was written before the recent November 5th federal election. So with the 2024 U.S. presidential election fast approaching, it may be time to focus less on voters and more on those who are trying to guarantee everyone's voices are heard. While Puerto Rico may not have sovereignty, there is a growing number of groups coming together to create spaces that can lead to a more dignified life. Despite the restless work, campaigning, and celebrating assemblies, Garcia Flores, the president of the community board of the Rio Piedras urban area, is clear on one thing. Without the community board, we wouldn't stand a chance. This kind of local organizing and insistence on participatory democratic processes are tools every community can use to ensure their lands and resources are being designed with them in mind. In the meantime, Figueroa Robles is focused on defending laws that allow Puerto Ricans to create systems of participatory democracy. We cannot hope for an ideal scenario in order to start creating other worlds and other realities. About the author, Laura M. Quintero is a Puerto Rican-based journalist with more than 10 years of experience. She is currently the editor of Nine Millones, an independent news outlet in Puerto Rico that focuses on solutions journalism. And Camille Padilla Dalmol is a journalist, educator, and founder of Nine Millones, an independent news outlet in Puerto Rico that focuses on solutions journalism. An article dated December 3, 2024 by Courtney E. Martin is part of the Progress 2025 series, We Can Solve Our Care and Housing Crises Together. An overhead shot shows a neighborhood. There are two roofs that are red rectangles. There's another one that's a bright blue awning. And we're looking down at some plots of gardens and walkways that are covered with metal sheeting. There are trees all around these buildings. Home sweet home is not quite so simple in the time of polycrises, economic, political, environmental. Far from the white picket fence propaganda of earlier eras, we must reimagine how we live and whom we live among, embracing the wisdom of limitations and sustainability, interdependence and multi-generational thriving, proximity and tenderness. It's time we met this precarious moment with the housing that honors it, so we can live the lives of care, dignity, and beauty that we all deserve. The Democrats seem to get this from the moment Vice Presidential candidate Tim Walz stepped into the public spotlight. He centered the importance of policies that honor care. It was a refreshing twist to hear from a man with the trappings of traditional masculinity, football, guns, and camo, who really gets why parental leave and child care are central to a thriving country. And of course, his running mate, Vice President Kamala Harris, put housing at the center of her economic platform, which included detailed plans to spur new construction and reduce costs for renters and homebuyers, largely through tax incentives. We will end America's housing shortage, she promised point blank in her speech at the Democratic National Convention. She also spoke widely and enthusiastically about her intention to create a Medicare at home benefit, which would have unlocked billions of federal dollars for in-home health aids, and other indispensable sources for care of our elders. By contrast, the Republican agenda, which is now confirmed to be outlined in the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 tome, will not only privatize Medicare and defund Medicaid, crucial care support for elders, but also intends to eradicate the Department of Education, gut the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and retreat from fair lending policies and other recent reforms within the real estate industry intended to cut down on racial discrimination. It's easy to be discouraged and even downright fearful of these shifts. For some of us, they are life-threatening. But we can't let our fear keep us from dreaming about a longer-term shift that would honor the universal labor of care in all of our lives. For too long, we have thought about housing and care in separate circles, when in fact, they are overlapping spheres. Where and how we live, the structures of our homes, the density of our neighborhoods, the division of public and private spaces influences everything about how we show up for one another in times of need. Despite the narrative being put forward by conservative forces right now, namely that all care needs can be met by unpaid labor within nuclear families, the reality is far more complex. We start as largely helpless little beings needing round-the-clock care, and while we don't like to think about it, we sometimes end life like that too. In between, there is illness, acute and chronic, Disability, which is also inevitable, though many of us struggle to acknowledge that reality until we're forced to reckon with it personally, and the run-of-the-mill cooking, cleaning, nurturing, calendaring, wiping of butts, listening over tea, processing of feelings, and so much more along the way. All of this, all of it, happens under the roof of a home, something too many in this country still struggle to access and hold on to. How we care for our people, how we share the care labor, who we even define as our people is drawn into the subtext of every blueprint and regional planning drawing. Historically, women of color have borne the brunt of caregiving in this country, often invisibilized and underpaid, a fact powerfully surfaced by the dignifying movement led by domestic workers and their allies in recent years. Most of the time, the dynamism between our built environment and our care labor is still largely unintentional. But among a growing number of wise and thoughtful advocates, it is becoming the text, not the subtext. Take Washington-based Frolic Communities, an innovative new response to the issue of gentrification. Frolic works with single-family homeowners to co-develop multifamily housing on their properties, which they live in alongside their children and other friends and community members. Homes in these projects, unlike so many cooperative models, can be purchased with low down payments and are affordable to middle-income families, and, importantly, are designed with care in mind. Multiple generations can live, cook, eat, play, and support one another through the typical struggles of daily life. More and more, urban areas are adjusting zoning policy to create more density. Co-founder Josh Morrison believes, as he told me, that the process can be more graceful and kind by utilizing new financing models and care-conscious design. Frolic has three sizable projects under its belt already, one of which is fully built and thriving. We're at the end of our time for today, so I'll stop there even though we haven't finished the article. You have been tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. In Flagstaff, I am your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder. Thanks a lot for listening.